KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, April 18, 2002, for broadcast at this time. Today's speakers will be Lourdes Govea, Associate Professor of Sociology and Director of Chicano Latino Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and Ed Leahy, Organizer of the Iowa-Nebraska Immigrant Rights Network. They'll speak on and discuss the topic, The Changing Faces of Nebraska. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Chris Allen, Assistant Professor in the Department of Communications at UNO and a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Allen. I'm from the University of Nebraska at Omaha Department of Communication, and I have the pleasure of moderating this afternoon's Press Club Forum. At least once a month, the Press Club, through its Education Committee, sponsors a forum of interest to club members and to the community at large. The forums are open to everyone. You do not have to be a member of the Press Club to attend. Today's program is being taped by KIOS for rebroadcast. When outsiders think of Nebraska, they most often think of a flat, featureless state that grows corn and cows. We Nebraskans, even us fairly new ones like me, know different. It is a beautiful state with prairies, grasslands, sand hills, rivers, a few lakes, beautiful recreation areas. When we Nebraskans think of the population of Nebraska, we often think of a fairly homogeneous population, white, with a few African Americans, some Native Americans. But the fact is, Nebraska is as varied in its population as it is in its geography. And the face of Nebraska is changing much more quickly than its landscape. Our speakers today are the Director of Chicano Latino Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, Lourdes Govea, and the Organizer of the Iowa-Nebraska Immigrant Rights Network, Ed Leahy. I'll ask each to speak for 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll have a question and answer period following, as we always do. There are slips of paper and pencils on the table for you to jot down a question, and we'll come around and collect them and ask them from up here. Lourdes Govea earned her PhD from the University of Kansas. She joined the sociology department at UNO in 1989 and has been studying and writing about the complex relationship between global restructuring of agriculture and the meatpacking industry, the recruitment of Latino immigrants, and new communities of settlement. She is working on a study commissioned by the Nebraska legislature on the incorporation of Latino immigrant workers to Nebraska. Her other work and publications have been used by communities experiencing significant growth in their Latino immigrant populations. Besides her teaching and research, Lourdes is a board member of the Nebraska Appleseed Center for Law in the Public Interest and of the Chicano Awareness Center. She is frequently asked to consult with congressional staff and also works with governmental and non-governmental agencies on Latino and immigration issues. Lourdes, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. I apologize if my voice is a little hoarse. The focus on immigrant populations in the United States and in states like Nebraska is clearly fueled by the demographic changes that have occurred during the past two decades, especially between the last two decennial censuses. Much of that focus is centered on the Latino population. Immigration, and Latinos in particular, are indeed changing the face of America and the face of Nebraska. While still not reaching the proportions of the early 1900s, the 2000 census shows that foreign-born persons now make up about 12% of the U.S. population. In Nebraska, the percentage of foreign-born is well below that figure, about 4%, according to recent estimates, but nonetheless important. Whereas the overall population in the United States increased by slightly more than 13%, between 1990 and 2000, the Hispanic Latino population increased 58% during that same period. This is in the U.S. as a whole. Today, there are about 35 million plus Latinos in the United States. Together with Asians, Latinos are the major contributors to the foreign-born population in the states and also actually in Nebraska. As we all know, this unprecedented growth did not occur just in the traditional receiving states where Latinos have usually concentrated, such as Florida or New York or California or Texas. But we have seen states like Arkansas and Georgia and Delaware, and of course Midwestern states like Missouri or Kansas, and especially Nebraska, experiencing significant growth of the Latino population. Nebraska's population growth and its Latino population growth specifically was particularly significant. Today, the state's the state ranked fifth among the top states experiencing the greatest Latino population growth. The Latino population growth was about 155% between 1990 and 2000. And there are close to, I would say, at least 100,000 Latinos, even though the census reports about 94,000 in the state. Importantly, around half of Latinos in Nebraska today, as is the case in neighbor states like Missouri, have moved to or live in non-metropolitan communities. So in many cases, it is the rural communities of Nebraska, the ones that need the population migration the most, the ones that have also benefited the most from this in-migration. The Latino population in the United States and in Nebraska is also very young, and thus in their childbearing years, which is also very important for a state like Nebraska. As an indication of that, consider that nationally, the Hispanic Latino population has a median age of 25.9 years compared to the overall U.S. populations whose median age is about 35.3 years. In Nebraska, Latinos' median age is 13 years younger than that of the whites' median age. So why do they come? Immigration is often portrayed largely as an invasion of people yearning to escape hunger and persecution, pushed, in quotes, by the desperate circumstances and, quote-unquote, pulled by the comparative economic and political advantages that they find in the U.S. In fact, if you ask anyone who migrated at any point in time, they will give you amazingly similar answers as to why they came. To find a better job, to build a better future for their family, to build a better life away from poverty and lack of economic opportunities. But isn't that why we all move? When anybody asks us, why did you come to Nebraska, including all of us here from UNO who are not originally from the state, I can bet you that the answer will also make very similar kinds of sense, and it's that, you know, we come because we're looking for a better job, or we were offered that job and we didn't go anywhere else because this is where the job was offered. But the fact is that individual motivations and rational calculations alone does not a new immigrant stream create. Today, as in the past, the new immigration is driven primarily by a persistently high demand for their labor. And to get that labor, governments and employers do not just sit passively, waiting for the inevitable arrival of these masses yearning for a better life. In fact, governments and employers work very hard and mobilize a tremendous amount of resources and articulate all kinds of rationalizations to change immigration laws or other policy, not always overtly, but that will facilitate their access to these labor pools. So between the push and the pull, there is a lot that goes on and which is complex and not always understood by most of us. But for researchers like me, I think that's where the most interesting stories lie. What are the forces that ultimately act as vehicle and as catalyst between these potentially available labor forces and these actually realizable labor forces in particular states and in particular industry. In Nebraska, as in the rest of the United States, there is a great demand for highly skilled labor in the form of engineers or computer scientists, nurses, doctors, etc., who are particularly welcome, by the way, in rural areas. But the largest need for labor in this so-called new economy has been in low-wage industries, in sectors such as agriculture and food processing, including meatpacking. Active recruitment drives of employers who need these workers, along with lobbying Congress for laws that are preferential to the creation of these labor supplies have been some of the key catalysts transforming a potential labor supply into a real workforce. Whether a particular nationality group ends up in the United States from Latin America, let's say, or ends up in Britain, is also highly determined by the history of American military, political, economic, cultural, and even religious involvement and intervention in the sending countries. In other words, besides the active recruitment and active mobilization and lobbying of policymakers, when research shows us the data, it reveals an incredibly interesting pattern where most people come from areas where the United States has established connections with those areas. If you don't believe me, wait for the new Venezuelan exodus. that's likely to, that's predicted to increase quite dramatically. Latinos in Nebraska are not new. And in fact, their history reveals some of the things that I'm saying. In the 1920s, Hispanic, Mexican labor in particular was heavily recruited to come to work in the beet harvest in western Nebraska. During the 1940s and up to the 1960s, Latinos again were heavily recruited via a program that was organized between the Mexican and the U.S. government called the Bracero Program. At that time, U.S. government paid agents to go into the interior of Mexico to recruit workers needed during the Second World War period and spent a lot of public funds to make sure that employers had access to this important labor supply. The impact of Bracero was clearly felt in Nebraska and later in meatpacking plants that became the secondary source of employment for many of these workers. And by the time the meatpacking plant started closing down in South Omaha in the 1970s, a third of that labor force was Latino and Hispanic, and this is the 1970s. Of course, we all know that the major influx of Latinos to the state has occurred during the last 10 or 12 years, and a lot of that is also explained by the restructuring of the meatpacking industry, and as a very integral component of that restructuring, the search for new Latino labor. Or should I say, for new pools of cheap labor. So what are some of the implications of these changes? We can only scratch the surface here, but hopefully Ed will contribute to this, and also during the Q&A period we can answer some more questions. But let me just outline a couple of things. Demographically, unless we're in total denial, Latino and other forms of immigration to the state are a godsend. Barring this demographic shift, many more counties and metro areas would have lost population. As it is, over 50% of Nebraska counties lost population. And of course, none of those counties were recipient of new Latino migration. Instead, the state gained population, as did many communities that would have lost. Even natural growth, which is still the major contributor to the growth during the 1990-2000 periods, even that natural growth is buoyed by this new immigration, as Latinos have very high fertility rate and, as I said, are in their childbearing age. Beyond numbers, Nebraskans recognize other tangible and not so tangible benefits of this new immigration wave. In a study we are just finishing up, which Chris mentioned in his opening, we asked a sample of largely non-Latino agency and community representatives to list three assets they thought Latino immigrants brought to their communities. Overwhelmingly, the most common responses were, in this order, one, contributions to the economy and their work ethic, which is interesting. Second, cultural diversity. And third, family and religious values. To me, this seems like a perfect fit for Nebraska, doesn't it? Of course, there are challenges as well. For example, increased numbers of young people means the potential for school overcrowding and the need for new resources to meet the specific needs of a largely Spanish-speaking student population, with a high degree of turnover driven in part by the job insecurities and high injury rates that are characteristic of the main industry that employs them, which is the meatpacking industry. Lexington, the place where I have done most of my work, and Schuyler school districts report upwards of 60% of their enrollment as being of Hispanic origin. And one can safely assume most are newcomers to the state. Second, it also seems the potential for increased crime rates would correlate with the presence of this very young population, as crime rates are often correlated with age. And they're also correlated, certain kinds of crimes are also correlated with blue-collar versus white-collar kinds of crime. This is the kind of population that is young and is blue-collar and is often experiencing very insecure source of employment and vulnerable in many ways to predators of all kinds. The data about crime, however, is very conflicted because, interestingly enough, what Lexington and Grand Island and other communities are showing is that crime is going down. Some of that, of course, correlated with the economic boom of that seemed to have sort of ended or maybe we're back up. But on the other hand, there are certain crimes like domestic violence that seem to be increasing. Some of that may be related to the fact that as Latina women stay here longer and know the system better, they may be reporting these crimes more, and also access to services to victims of domestic violence who are immigrant are also is also increasing in interesting ways. Then there is the question on everyone's mind, will new immigrants assimilate into American society? Here I have to refer to two competing narratives of assimilation that are usually part of the American psychic. One is they will never learn English, they bring poverty, they have low levels of human capital, especially Latinos who have lower than average educational kinds of levels when compared to other immigrants such as Asians. Or the converse kind of narrative points that this is a win-win situation, that communities and states like Nebraska benefit from the arrival of immigrants, and immigrants will eventually assimilate and become Americanized and will be able to enjoy the opportunity for upward mobility that has been afforded to other groups. Well, research clearly shows that whether immigrants and newcomers successfully integrate into our community or not depends on whether they have opportunities to do so. The human capital of immigrants, the level of education and training that they bring is, of course, important, but it's by no means enough, and in many cases, it's not the determining factor. It is much more important the context of reception that we create for these new immigrants, and whether new immigrants become an asset or a liability is really more up to us than up to them. And that, the research has been very clear. And it's not just recent research. This shows very much to be the pattern throughout the history of migration to the United States. So this includes whether opportunities exist for Latinos to access good and better jobs, or whether they're going to become stuck in the same kind of low-wage labor to which many industries have become addicted, and frankly, also governments. And this is about economic development policies. This is not about immigration policies. This is about the kinds of development models that we want to create in our communities. Do we want our communities to depend only on industries that rely heavily on low-wage labor and unprotected labor, and therefore who puts us in a situation that we need to foster that, or we're not going to have industries? Or do we want to create models of development that diversify our economies and that produce job ladders for Latinos and non-Latinos to move up and to create a Nebraska with less exodus of brain drain and more opportunities for people to stay? So these are much larger questions than immigration. In our recent research, we asked respondents what were the greatest challenges to overcome in order to facilitate the integration of Latino immigrants into their communities. And the answers paralleled what the literature is saying, such as this emphasis on job. The first barrier they pointed out was language. Now, this has to be dissected somewhat because the research is also very clear that contrary to popular opinion, immigrants and Latinos in particularly are very interested in learning the language. But again, motivations and drive are not enough. We need to create the conditions whereby learning a second language is possible. The United States is an incredibly, it's changing, but traditionally has been an incredibly monolingual country. And people who have not learned a second language have very little idea of what it takes to learn a language. And I think it is important to look at what the research says, and there is plenty. That shows, for example, that if you have people working too many hours, if the ESL, English as a second language, classes are few and far between, or are really classes that do not allow proficiency beyond what is called survival English, you're not going to train a population that is going to be ready to assume the kinds of jobs we want them to assume later. And this affects especially those who are unemployed and are not able to get a job because of lack of English. This affects women in particular, who tend to have lower level of English language proficiency. And interestingly, this affects many women and men as well who come here not unskilled, not de-skilled, but with all kinds of professional degrees, who are nurses, geriatric aides, even doctors, accountants, many of the occupations that would do wonders for a state of like Nebraska, but who find all kinds of barriers learning English or having access to English classes that they can take, or childcare that they can use in order to be able to attend their classes. There are a few efforts being made, and I want to make a plug for the Mammal Foundation and the Museo Latino, who are beginning to look into this and have some interesting projects. Then there is an issue of cultural conflicts and community intolerance. This was mentioned by almost everyone that we surveyed, pointing out that even religious organizations, especially in these smaller communities, that the congregations were sometimes quite intolerant of new arrivals, but at the same time pointing out that there is an increasingly critical mass of people who are very supportive and who do appreciate diversity. And finally, of course, the type of jobs and the low wages that seem to trap Latinos, as I said earlier, in situations whereby their children, especially, who, by the way, will be primarily U.S.-born children, these are American kids, do not have a lot to hope for. And this is where we really need to pay attention to, because combined with absence of legal status and legal protection, our future is highly compromised. The benefits, the short-term benefits of immigration to the state, the fact that the state being a highly low-wage state is benefiting from the influx of low-wage adults, that short-term benefit is going to go away very soon, because believe me, these children are not looking at these occupations as their option. They do not want the jobs that their parents have. When they see them come home at night with their hands swollen, exhausted, with no time for anything, these children have learned to have the same American aspiration of any teenage children, and they want the same things. And when they cannot get them, then the danger of downward assimilation into gangs and criminal activities, into desperation, are very real. And I think in this sense, it's incumbent upon all of us to really track the kinds of policies that we want to protect those children, which is the same as to protecting our future. Thank you.
Thank you, Lourdes. Ed Leahy, I should mention in full disclosure that I've actually lifted many of these words directly from the biographical sketches that they gave me, so please consider that a footnote, just in case the plagiarism patrol is out there. Ed Leahy has organized for the Iowa-Nebraska Immigrant Rights Network, which is sponsored by the Nebraska Appleseed, since last November. He became an activist in immigrant issues as a Catholic priest serving Hispanic communities in Chicago, St. Louis, and Minneapolis. He organized not only his parishes, but also the labor, religious, business, and political communities to respond to the suffering of immigrants. He won, I think it's $72,000. Is that the figure? $72,000 for immigrant workers in Minneapolis who had revolted and tried to form a union to battle their exploitation. Those immigrants were then arrested in their efforts and turned over to the INS. Ed left the ministry in July 2000 and worked for the Department of Children and Family Services in Illinois, and also worked with immigrant families caught in a cycle of violence and abuse. He has been busy since November organizing and launching the Immigrants' Rights Network. Ed Leahy.
Thank you. My friends, perhaps I'll begin by just trying to capsulize a little bit what the plan of the network is, which largely flows from the task force investigation and the realization that there was a necessary or a need for a unified voice in our state to speak with immigrant communities and on behalf of immigrant communities and to help immigrant communities speak for themselves about these various issues that are confronting them in their integration into our society in the USA. The network's seeds really developed out of the, in 1999 when the Immigration and Naturalization Service began an operation called Operation Vanguard, which targeted the meatpacking industry as a whole and began reviewing documents of the workers and then taking enforcement actions in a concentrated and very intense way in that industry. The result of that was that many families were divided. The reality for many immigrant families is that often they exist in a split status symbol, where maybe one spouse might be a legal permanent resident, the other spouse might be technically undocumented, some children might also be undocumented who came with the spouse to join the family, and then some children are born in this country and are actually U.S. citizens. So you have maybe three divisions within one family. The response of the community and different agencies who serve the immigrant community to that operation formed a round table of collaboration that was unseen in Nebraska at that time. And the idea afterwards, they effectively stopped that operation through the community pressure, publicity, and political pressure, saying that this was not a fair way of enforcing the immigration laws of our country by targeting and specifically profiling and indeed attacking communities that are supporting our economy. Therefore, then, these agencies and these groups that had come together around that table to battle that idea decided that it was necessary to continue working together. And that's where the idea for the Immigrant Rights Network came from. Funding was found and some priorities were set, and then some 2 years later is when we were actually able to launch the network. In the interim time, since I've been employed by Nebraska Appleseed, what I have done is talk to community leaders, to those same agencies who were a part of that operation, and also other agencies which serve immigrant communities, to identify some core values that link us together. And those core values are that our nation benefits more by having a fair and generous immigration policy than from having a restrictive policy, especially since our economy has turned into a service economy, since we transformed that in the early 90s and we saw the economic boom that that brought. We needed and recognized that immigrant labor was a significant part of that. Economic studies done throughout our region and that are still needed to be conducted in Iowa and in Nebraska illuminate that sometimes as much as 10% of a state's budget and income is based on immigrant labor, and many times based on undocumented immigrant labor. And to remove that from our workforce would have devastating effects to our economy. One statistic that sticks in my mind from my experience in Minnesota was that each undocumented immigrant provided 40 other jobs up the ladder for other Minnesotans. And to remove those undocumented people from our labor force would create a tremendous increase in the unemployment rate. The other value that is central to our network is to advocate for integration of newcomers into our communities. that has two prongs. First, to the immigrant communities themselves, to help them to understand the American values. This is a nation of immigrants. It is built on immigrants. Immigrants come here because they value some of the same things we all do: freedom, democracy, the opportunity to seek out your own destiny, to work and with the sweat of your labor, see benefits for yourself and for your children. I'm the youngest of 10 children in my family and the only one in my family to have been able to go to college. That's because my immigrant parents were poor, and we were poor growing up. But all of my brothers and sisters went to work, got their basic education through high school by my parents constantly pressing on us, and through the economy generated in my own family enabled at least one of us to get to college. And that was an incredible day for my family. When I graduated for the entire family, and in some senses for my culture. And that was an important thing. We see this in the Latino community. We see it also in the Sudanese community here in Omaha. Is finally, our children will be able to have an education. They won't have to go to work in the fields. They won't have to work for the bare minimum of survival. That is really a dream and a hope. The other and the final value that I have heard coming from interviews with immigrant leaders and these agencies is that full participation is important. And so as people begin to naturalize and come into full status in our society, that they activate on their all the democratic principles which have been the strength of our country, that they learn to vote, they know how to vote, they know how to interpret and political issues, read the newspapers, be informed, participate in their communities, PTA meetings, all the way around. And so this kind of full participation is something that will benefit us all. I neglected to mention, and I apologize, that the other prong as well in the integration agenda is not only towards the immigrant community but towards the non-immigrant community, to help many of us deal with the change that does happen. I've gotten many phone calls from people in rural communities who say they're taking over and our way of life is disappearing. These aren't our values. But in many ways, we've heard that those values are Nebraskan values: the work ethic, focus on family, and the desire for success. That's what I've heard in coming here, and that's what I see as been the strength of the heartland. And so to help non-immigrant communities learn about immigrant communities and about the issues that face them, and to really redress some of the restrictionist agenda points that are constantly put out there. In Iowa particularly, having just passed their campaign of the English-only law this past legislative session, many communities experienced a specific targeting in that state by people from outside of that state, national interest groups and others, who were exacerbating on the fears of the non-immigrant communities and playing up the differences between these communities. And a lot of that really was racial, cultural, and linguistic. And they say that English is the reason that we are all bonded together as a people. I don't think that is the truth. I think what bonds us together as a people, again, is that desire for freedom, is the sense of due process and justice and law that governs our society. And those are the things that other people are seeking. When you are in a country and you don't have the opportunity for even the most basic things necessary for a genuine human life, housing, food, education, privacy, freedom of religion, you have a right to immigrate. You have a right to go in search of somewhere where you can live your human life. And if there is a right to emigrate with an E, there is a corresponding right to immigrate with an I, to come to some place, to be received. And I think that there is so much hope that is alive in these communities. in my 15 years in ministry, that is often what sustained me. There wasn't budget. There wasn't plans. There wasn't, you know, endless opportunities. We struck together as a community to build our churches, to grow and educate our children, and to become a force in our society. And it was a tremendous thing to watch. And it was something that educated me about the truth of being American. Just yesterday, I was at Metro Community College at the South Omaha campus, and they had an international fair. There's a significant international community in that school. And what was interesting was, while English served as the common language, when a Sudanese approached the Iranian woman who had the table next to me, they struggled in English to learn what was the food she was offering and celebrating about her country. And she said, oh, that's made with flowers. And he says, like plants? and no, it was really flour, you know, the white powdery stuff that we're used to, not anthrax. And the dialogue that happened between them wasn't so important in terms of the language. It was the smiles, it was the acceptance, it was the willingness to learn about the other person, to really come on a heart-to-heart connection. And it was marvelous to witness that happening also at the Chilean table, at the Hmong table, at the Pakistani table. And to see these kinds of interactions and celebration and the creation of a genuine community who was willing to learn about each other. That is what I think we're called to as a society. That is what I think any education that we might have would tell us is the end product. It is not about fear of others. It is not about this is a strange costume that you wear, or that is a weird food and you're not like me. No, it is about realizing that there is only one race, our human race. And what binds us together isn't our language, it is what our heart tells us. And to witness that yesterday, I just wish that that could explode on the scene all over this region. And I think it will. Because our hope through the work of the network is to bring people of good conscience and goodwill together and to collaboratively work and bring a reasonable dialogue to the necessary changes that have to happen. This past week, since Congress came back after their spring recess, has been an incredibly busy week on the immigration front. There are a number of bills that have been either passed or are currently being debated or being voted on, even as we speak. For example, the restructuring of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, a necessary thing. Immigrant advocates, people who work for INS, the community at large recognizes this is long overdue. September 11th has only escalated the need for that to happen. And so the plan that eventually won out through advocate groups on the national scene who are linked in on the local scene with agencies and ideas and networks like our own, we're able to influence and see that that plan will effectively balance the twofold mission of INS between enforcement and also service. Now, having an agency that can service people and help them to through the process to become American citizens is important. But along with that, other reforms in law in general are necessary. And so Congress also was considering an important extension of the immigration law in a particular section called 245I, which would enable families to regularize their status without having to return to their country of origin and go through the U.S. Embassy in that country to, you know, receive the necessary visas to prove marriage or relationship or something like that. This important benefit will help approximately 400,000 people in the interim regularize their status and equalize that division that goes on within a family. There's the debate today about the restoration of welfare benefits for legal permanent immigrants. In 1996, in the reform of welfare, the agenda cut out legal immigrants from being able to receive things like food stamp, aid for children, other benefits, Medicaid, and things like that. And it's important to restore these benefits because many of those immigrant communities who were isolated from that, and I can identify one group in particular, the Hmong, actually helped our U.S. servicemen during the Vietnam War tremendously. And they came to this country as refugees because they were identified as being collaborators with the American forces. And here they come to this country, some of them with years of service, serving as translators, serving as guides, opening their villages and giving aid to our soldiers, and being left out in the cold simply because they were immigrants. And even the fashioners of that original plan, Newt Gingrich in particular, said, we went too far. That wasn't right. That wasn't just. But that restrictionist voice is still out there, and it's saying, no, we ought not restore those benefits. This is costing us money. Our economy is fragile right now. Our recovery can't afford to have benefits towards these communities who aren't really part of us yet. Well, again, I think Lourdes illuminated many points that indicate that if we don't attend to these populations, which are young, which are predominantly children, we are shooting ourselves in the foot as far as the future goes. There are indeed great things that we can share with these newcomers. And there are indeed great things that these newcomers can teach us. All we need to do is open our minds and our hearts to this, and to do this in a conscious and active way. And so one way is to educate ourselves about these proposals, educate our politicians who vote on these proposals, and bring a reasoned voice to the table, a unified voice, a voice that includes and reflects all of us and our communities. In recent weeks, since our network has been more officially launched, as our different regions are coming together, and we're going to have our first meeting of the Omaha region next Wednesday, April 24th, 7 p.m. at the Chicano Awareness Center, 4821 South 24th Street. And this is a tremendous step because it says that now people in this region, Omaha and its surroundings, even Omaha and Council Bluffs as far as Red Oak, these area about an hour drive from around, can come together and we can have a voice. We have a listserv in which on our electronic listserv as we update information on the network and legislative process, what happens is that several other national groups and different leaders also are on that listserv and have begun to recognize, oh, there's stuff going on in Nebraska and Iowa. And that has elevated our status as a whole on the national scene. The longest time, the New Yorker's perspective of America was New York, the Allegheny Mountains, there was maybe the Mississippi River, and then Los Angeles. The heartland was skipped over. And the heartland is often skipped over in all kinds of politics. But now people are starting to talk about the heartland because the heartland is just like the rest of the country. And we are starting to reflect that in even our smallest communities. So I think there's great hope in this community. I think there's great hope for all of us, and I think that immigrants have an awful lot to teach us. And they teach us mostly about those things that we treasure and hold so dear. Our freedom, the ability to progress, the truth and the justice that is indeed the American way, the things that bind us as one nation under God. E pluribus unum. Yes, from my priesthood days, out of many, one. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed. We have about 15 minutes left and a whole handful of questions here, so I'll try to get through as many of them as we can. describe, either one of you, describe how well Latinos are being absorbed into communities in Nebraska. Are there a lot of conflicts?
Well, there are conflicts. I think there's always conflicts when you come across somebody who is different from you. That's natural to recognize. But again, I think there are steps that we can take to overcome that. I was fortunate to have given a workshop recently at St. Francis Hospital in West Point, Nebraska. And many of the staff there had some questions about how to deal with this community of Latinos that has grown in their neighborhood and whom they are starting to serve. And it's interesting, the hospital really had a very strong geriatric program, but now it's prenatal care. And the transformation that has gone over in that one isolated incident, I think, is indicative of a lot of other places. What I found was that when we were able to have the dialogue amongst the employees, that they were able to voice their frustration in dealing with people, in dealing with the language barrier. They were able to voice their frustration in other kinds of questions that they have as far as processing insurance forms and the different means that the community has to take in order to survive in this country sometimes has people using different names or different kinds of identification and all that. How do we just sort through all of this and attend to the healthcare needs and complete our mission, but also attend to the human needs in the interactions that we have? What was so wonderful about it was that people talked and were able to express and say, okay, this is what bugs me, this is what I don't understand, but then at the same time, after expressing that frustration, we're also willing to learn about the community and realize there are other things that we can do. Oh, we could have some magazines that are in Spanish in our waiting room so that people who have to wait in the clinic for hours on end sometimes have something to read. We could have more children's toys and designate an area so that families wouldn't be so stressed and the children would be able to play. We could make sure that our signage in our hospital reflects the languages of our community and that people know where they're going. And then energy just started to flow from the group as they thought there are things that we can do and that we can do together to resolve some of the frustrations and conflicts and challenges that naturally have come about. What was important was, I don't think that dialogue wouldn't have happened unless the administration was open to talking about this. Rather than sticking our head in the sand and saying, oh, it's changing, they were rather proactive and saying, how can we make this change benefit us all and progress our mission and move us all forward?
Undocumented workers are, in fact, here illegally. Isn't there an obligation to stop illegal immigration?
I think there is an obligation to recognize that these workers are needed. I think it's time to own up to the fact that the United States participates quite actively through all kinds of means to attract workers here. Workers are not machines or washing machines or pegs. They are parts of families. And often what you find is within the same family, individuals who have different legal statuses. The dad might have come legally or illegally, and then there is a whole combination of other statuses because families must come. Sometimes the dad comes legally and has tremendous difficulties in bringing the rest of the family legally, which produces illegality. I think it's time to own up to the fact that we cannot have it both ways. If we need this kind of labor, if we need migration, if we recognize that we, through all kinds of direct and indirect means, have contributed to the formation of this flow, that the answer is legalization and the answer is giving people full rights rather than contributing to illegal immigration. You know, one thing that few Americans know is that the explosion of undocumented migration occurs at the end of the Bracero program, when thousands upon thousands of workers that had been lured to the United States for what was supposed to be a short term ended up staying longer in large part because the act that brought him here, the legal act that brought him here, kept being extended at the request of very powerful growers in places like California and Texas who needed that labor. So the act was supposed to be a temporary stopgap measure to supply labor during the Second World War, but it was 1964 and the act was still active. Then conditions begin to change nationally. There's an increasing restlessness toward immigration. People begin to want to look at immigration again, and suddenly thousands upon thousands of families find themselves illegally after living in the United States for years and years, after raising their families here. And that was one among several moments in which the explosion of undocumented labor was not created by some massive invasion of people, was created by a de facto and overnight change in the law that suddenly transformed thousands of people that were legal into illegal workers. And once you create that, again, people are not just labor. While industries like meatpacking or growers in California may look at them as just labor, they're not just labor. They want what everybody else wants. They want to raise a family. They are human beings. And you cannot treat them simply like you treat export and import of capital or pegs or washing machines, that when you have enough, you turn it off. Once these networks are created historically, beginning with, by the way, the annexation of Mexico that overnight converted thousands of people also into immigrants in their own country. That was the earlier part of the creation of undocumented and documented migration. You cannot turn it off that easily because people build families and build histories and are just as committed to live a productive and successful life here as whether they have a piece of paper that says they're legal or not. So, no, I think that the responsibility is for us to own up to the fact that we have used and abused this labor, and it's time for us to recognize that they have rights. Thank you.
What percentage of Hispanics in Nebraska are undocumented workers?
On the national scene, generally it's about 20%, and that would include all kinds of immigrants. It's hard to really specifically profile one community because, again, many families have that mixed status. And many people don't actually become undocumented immediately. They might have entered this country legally on a tourist visa and overstayed that visa. And so it's very hard to pinpoint. But generally, it wouldn't be more than 20%. And it's more often statistically, in my experience in other communities, between 8 and 11% is usually what I have experienced.
One of the problems Latinos have is the failure of those eligible to vote. What plans do you have to counter this problem? And as a related question, what are the voting qualifications for immigrants, new citizens, I guess, is what they would be?
Starting, and you can...
Okay.
I'm not so sure what the question is in terms of their failure of those eligible to... The low voting rate?
I guess that would be it, yeah.
Turnout, maybe.
Yeah, vote turnout, low turnout rate. Let me just say that if we look at the issue historically, it's fascinating how similar, with their own differences, but how similar some of the trends are. I was looking at a student's thesis last night that points out how in other moments in history, there were relatively low levels of naturalization. That people were not running, to get naturalized, unless pressure by certain threats. For example, in the 1920s, and when the anti-immigrant wave against Southern and Eastern Europeans became quite significant, people rushed to naturalize. Something like that is happening right now, where the naturalization rates are very high, which unfortunately, in a way, correspond in part to the fears that people feel about their insecurity, their restrictive policies that Ed was talking about. And so I think we will see, and we are seeing, not only did we see higher rates of naturalization, but if I know the data correctly, actually Nebraska saw an interesting increase in immigrants who were voting and Latinos who were voting. So actually we did see an increase, and I think nationally as well. And I think what's happened is that Latinos are beginning to feel, despite all the restrictive policies and despite all the enduring racism and discrimination, the numbers themselves and the need of communities and states to face up to the reality that those numbers are very much part of our life and our future are beginning to convey to Latinos the real message that, you know, we can participate in this society. It is worth voting. We can make a difference. And I think that in itself sends that message, that if you create a context of reception that says, we accept you as equal, you are a citizen, regardless of what the legal paper says. Citizens mean those who are productive and producing. And, of course, to vote, you do have to have the legal paper. But if we create that sense of incorporation, you know, assimilation towards an upward trend and positive kinds of environments is an easy step from there.
The only other things that I would add into that is that, indeed, Latino voting is on the rise. And because it's on the rise, it has attracted the attention of both national parties. Traditionally, Latinos have tended to be Democratic, but they are being heavily recruited by the Republican Party now because in the last election, their vote also made a big difference. The enthusiasm for immigration reform that was present in the country in the 2000 election, and that got a little bit sidetracked with the whole Florida flub-up, and then also with September 11th when the issues began to be clouded between that immigration is not terrorism and terrorism is not immigration, is one of the reasons that that enthusiasm is still present and that we have so many different types of immigrant legislation going on currently, and that trend will continue until we have resolved some of these questions like the undocumented status of people. So Latinos are voting. They need to continually be encouraged to vote, and in any program, and again, I think that is a value that we hold in the network, is that we would help immigrants who naturalize to understand the importance of voting and continuing to defend the kinds of freedom and things that drew them here in the first place. And on a personal note, let me say that the last time that I voted, I went with a young lady who had turned 18 and now was eligible to vote. She was Latino. And when we went up to the registration table and she had her voter's registration card there and she had her ID, she was questioned and she was insulted and she was overly inspected simply because she was a Latino. And so sometimes if people don't vote, it's because they feel my voice doesn't matter or my vote won't matter. And that is a mistaken message that we have to be careful to get out there and to communicate with the communities.
If I can add, you brought up a very important point that I also wanted to emphasize, that, barely 50% of Americans vote anyway, so we have a problem in the country. This is not a Latino problem. So voting rates are not particularly high. But also these obstacles among the poor, among minority populations, the research has shown over and over and over, and data collection by political groups has shown over and over and over, that there are particular obstacles that continue to inhibit the poor and minorities from voting. So those are also important barriers that we need to look at, and those are the challenges and the barriers to positive integration that complement the kinds of research that we need to do.
I wish we could continue the discussion, but we've come to the end of our time. I'd like to thank our two guests today, Professor Lourdes Govea and Mr. Ed Leahy. I'd like to thank you for participating, and we are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's topic was The Changing Faces of Nebraska. The guest speakers were Lourdes Govea, Associate Professor of Sociology and Director of Chicano Latino Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and Ed Leahy, organizer of the Iowa-Nebraska Immigrant Rights Network. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, April 18, 2002, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Deborah Smith Howell of the UNO Department of Communications for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be on Thursday, May 16th at 12 noon. The guest speaker will be Mike Fahey, Mayor of Omaha. He'll talk about his first year in office. If you'd like to attend this or other future forums, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.